tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. My guest is Spalding Gray, who takes stories about his life and about his anxieties and indecision and transforms them into comic theater monologues. There's none of the posturing and bombast that you might associate with one-man shows. Gray's performances are very direct. He sits at a table with a microphone, a glass of water, and his notebook and talks to the audience as if they were friends he was confiding in. This is a form he basically made up, so you can't really compare him to other people doing it. But theater critics have drawn parallels between him and Woody Allen in the way that they both humorously mine their neurosis, and his performances have also been mentioned alongside the film My Dinner with Andre, and how they've both taken what appears to be just talking and made it into great theater or film. Gray's monologues include Sex and Death to the Age of 14, which is about his first encounters with sex, with death and his sexual initiations. A Personal History of the American Theater is about his experiences in the 50 roles he performed between 1960 and 70. Swimming to Cambodia is based on his observations while acting in the film The Killing Fields, in which he played an American attaché. His current monologue, The Terrors of Pleasure, chronicles his attempts to grow up and experience the joys of ownership by buying a house in the Catskills, which turned out to be a disaster and compelled him to go off to L.A., auditioning for sitcom roles to help pay for the home repairs. Whatever the subject of a Spalding Gray monologue is, it's usually, ultimately, an ironic reflection on the big questions, like the meaning of life. Spalding Gray is an alumni of the New York Experimental Theater Company, The Performance Group. He hasn't yet convinced the television networks that he's good sitcom material, but he's won over the art and theater worlds. A book of his monologues is about to be published by Vintage, titled Sex and Death to the age of 14. He's also featured in the forthcoming David Byrne film, True Stories. And in June, he does a three-week run at Lincoln Center with his monologue, The Terrors of Pleasure. Now, I understand they're billing it as a world premiere, but the truth is you can see it this weekend at the Painted Bright Art Center tonight through Saturday night. They're at 2nd and Vine Streets. And for information, you can call 925-9914. That's 925-9914. Now, I just want to tell our listeners this is not a rebroadcast.
Right.
We've run that interview many times. This is brand new. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Really loved your show, and it's great to see you.
Just one thing about the Lincoln Center. That'll be 4 weeks, and I'm going to do Sex and Death and Swimming to Cambodia as well as Terra's Pleasure. It opens with 2 weeks of Terra's Pleasure, then goes back to the original monologue, first one, Sex and Death, and then a 90-minute version of Swimming to Cambodia that I worked up in Perth, combining the two parts, so it's the best of.
That's great. So the whole thing's like a little retrospective.
Yeah, it is.
That's great. In your monologue that you're doing in Philadelphia now, you describe how you had to go to Los Angeles to audition for sitcom roles to get the money that you needed to fix up this house that you bought. Were there really other reasons why you were going to audition in sitcoms too?
This particular monologue is an example of what I do, the closest I come to fiction, and that's cutting up. So really there are two experiences there that happened at two different times. There was dealing with the house, and then there was the Hollywood experience. And I just thought, you know, for instance, I was chosen by the director to come in audition for the Farrah Fawcett TV thing in Chicago. He flew out to Chicago to see me perform at the Goodman Theater, and I was doing Swimming to Cambodia. We went out for a drink afterwards. He says, I think you are perfect for this role. One thing I want you to promise me is that you will not do a monologue about this experience, you know. And I should have said, I won't do a monologue if I get the role. But now, so there's a little breakup in time there. I didn't actually run into him in Hollywood, so I cut it to make it work for me. So I thought it would be an interesting juxtaposition of saying Catskills versus Hollywood. All the stories are true. It's just a matter of telescoping and cutting the time to make it fit.
I guess it's gotten to the point now where people want you to make pledges that you won't do monologues about them and maybe make them look bad.
Well, a little bit. I remember when I was auditioning during that run of auditions where I decided I wouldn't make any judgment, and I would try to pacify my agent by going up for everything they sent me. That mainly I was doing that when I was out performing in L.A. just about a year ago. And I just was there and was going up for everything. I was doing Swimming to Cambodia. And I remember coming into an audition that I was very good for, actually. I was supposed to play a doctor that was kind of comic. And I walked in, and the casting director just threw up her arms when she saw me, and she said, we don't want to hear any stories about this. Laugh, 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 and then I proceed not to get the role. So there's a bit of unconscious, a very conscious blacklisting going on. I think in at least in that scene, which isn't, you know, it's not the high film scene. I'm not really yearning for TV, although it might be fun to do it. But I think they're saying, look, when you really give up this reflection, when you give up this commentary, this being a writer, and join the lowly, unconscious, wealthy actors of L.A. and be like one of them, because we are in control, then we'll give you a job.
So you're supposed to renounce your past and renounce what you've done and
join
their
your
ranks.
You have to pay your Hollywood dues, I think. Yeah, because my dues have been paid in a completely different area that they respect, intimidated by, but they do, that it's not their currency. Avant-garde theater, blah, blah, blah.
See, I think of you in a way as being proof of the theory that you can't just sell out. It's not that easy. That you have to have the sensibility too. You know, that if you don't have the sensibility, you just can't sell out
that
well.
It is funny. It is funny. I'm having a hard time doing it.
Are you the leading man type when you go up for the roles?
You know what's happening now? I'm up for a film called Punk Daddy. Crazy title. I hope they change it, but. It's not all that bad a film. It's written and directed. It's going to be directed by Nick Kazan, Alia Kazan's son. And when I got back from Australia, just 2 weeks ago, I was there for 4 months. There were four film scripts on my desk. They wanted me to go up for immediately. One was The Witches of Eastwick, a pretty good adaptation of the Updike book. The other was a Rudy Wurlitzer, Robert Frank collaboration called Candy Mountain, and the third was this Punk Daddy. And I went in for Witches of Eastwick thinking, oh, you know, because I used to make jokes about when people would call me and say, do you have a Kentucky accent? My agent would call for a film. I said, no, but when you get to the guy in Rhode Island, you know, the Rhode Island accent, and here it is, Witches of Eastwick takes place in Rhode Island. Oh, they got Jack Nicholson in the thing. And I was supposed to play this really like, I was auditioning for a video because the director had just flown out to L.A. and I just missed him. So they had a video camera. And I was supposed to play this really... oh, sexy school teacher. I mean, a real cocky bastard that really just has got all the women under his thumb and completely confident, you know, in the worst way, real blown up ego. And I was trying to get George Bush as an image in my head, actually. You know, I was trying to do this thing really like iron cold. And I would watch the replays of that video, which was very interesting because that teaches you something. And inevitably, there was this kind of soft humor that was leaking through at the edges, you know. And that's when I knew that I wasn't, you know, an actor's actor the way De Niro is, you know. And as soon as there was any kind of pause or open space, there would be all of this personality coming through. So I knew I wouldn't get the role. But for Punk Daddy, it's working. I've had my call back, you know, a second time. They absolutely want me. It's one of these Oedipal movies. It's kind of like that Irish movie where the son can't kill the father. What is it? It's banned in Ireland, actually. I've forgotten the name of it. I'm not Plowing the Stars. But anyway, it's one of these Oedipal fantasies where the punk son finally kills the father and buries him in the couch. But he never decomposes and the police come and forgive the son. You know, it's a fantasy. I'm playing the father. And I did a wonderful improv, because I'm real good at improv, so I'm not good at reading lines, and knocked them on the floor. The only problem is this. It's back to the old problem. The producer, who has final say in whether or not who the casting is, because, you know, they want names, won't cast me unless they convince the producer that I am known nationally. So I had to get together a whole file. Like Vogue magazine just recently wrote a little profile on me. You send in the Vogue, you send in the Vanity Fair. And finally, you know, if you have enough of those articles, they begin to cast you in these ridiculous films. It's such a slow process. And I'll be 45 in June.
Yeah, so I guess you have to be in a movie to really make movies, to convince people that you're box office.
Yeah, you have to have a solid role. I mean, I've done, you know, small supporting roles, good little vignettes here and there.
I'm not convinced,
Playboy
really.
Playboy of the Western World. That's the play.
Oh, the Irish one you think of. Yeah. I'm really not convinced that you could do well on a sitcom.
I don't think I could.
Because you do some of the lines that you had to do readings of in your monologue. And those lines are just absurd. They're just so ultra television. I can't imagine it.
You can't help but taking off on them. Mm-hmm. You know? For me, I mean, I couldn't help but doing them ironically. I can't resist that finding the humor in the situation.
You were tested with Farrah Fawcett Majors to see if there was chemistry between you.
Right, three-day test. Yeah.
What was going through your mind during that? Because I know that's just not the kind of acting that you've really aspired to.
A lot of that was saying, now look, I'm in a foreign situation here. Really try to drop the judgment. Go back to the kind of, it was like the kind of scene work I had done in college where I was thinking of myself then as a young romantic lead. And I was really trying to go back and play this painter that I was supposed to be, and she was supposed to be my model, New England painter. And I was very sincere, and I was not bad. I saw the video of it, and the director was supposed to send me the raw video footage, and he freaked. He was afraid that I would do something with it publicly, even though I promised I wouldn't, because he was just afraid of being exposed. But I saw those video playbacks, and a lot of what I did was very dramatic, very intense, but one of the interesting things that I noticed was that my face was totally alive, like amoebic, like a protein, all moving and shifting, and my mouth was so expressive, and I'd be touching myself. And I realized that TV people, Farrah is an example, know how to keep a still face so you can project the emotion on them. They are like Zen, in Zen meditation. They don't, and my face was just crawling. And I thought, that would be weird on TV. It wouldn't work. I could understand why when they saw the video. It was just so expressive.
Do people in Hollywood tell you to lighten up and, you know, not worry about sex and death and the kinds of things that you talk about in monologues?
You know, mainly I went through that with the audition for the Johnny Carson show. That was just when they kept saying, you've got to just censor more, and not, no, edit more, the dark stuff. Just keep it light, because that's, you know, you do that well, why blend it with the dark? And for me, that's just really, that's it for me. That balance between the two is what I'm always going for. And when he said I wasn't a good self-editor, I was really, you know, upset with that too, because I'm very, very aware of editing when I'm working.
You're going to be in a David Byrne movie. I guess he directed it?
He directs it and acts in it, and it's a wonderful film, True Stories. It's kind of like a musical version of Our Town, only it takes place in a small town in Texas, and David plays the narrator, like the Our Town narrator, and also would run off camera to direct. Ed Lockman was on camera, who shot Desperately Seeking Susan, and David had the whole thing mapped out exactly what he wanted. Beth Henley wrote the script, and then David took the script and deconstructed it and cut it up to his liking. So it's just a lot of characters that are like idiosyncratic small town with no names. Like you have the cute lady who dies of cuteness in the film, the lying woman, the lazy woman. Susie Kurtz plays that. She's in bed all the time. And I play the civic leader. Who I haven't spoken to my wife in 7 years. We speak only through the children. We're still together because of that. And so we have two kids. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful doing that film. I'm the only one that doesn't sing it. It's original soundtrack by the Talking Heads, which everyone laid tracks over, you know, so each person had their own song. Pop Staples is in it from the Staples Singers. A lot of performance people and people who hadn't acted before. Pops had never acted before. And again, like the Killing Fields, I was there for 7 weeks because David wanted everyone there as a community, whether I was working or not.
So you still, I mean, it looks like you can really do this on your own terms, you know, that you could do acting and movies
pretty much on your own terms. It always works when the directors come to me and not audition me. David didn't do that. Roland Jaffe came to me for the Killing Fields and didn't audition. I'm very bad at auditions. I'm very bad under pressure. It's when the director sees what they... When the director has the vision to see in me what they can use, directors come and see me perform, but most of them aren't intelligent enough to be able to get the essence out of it, to extract the writing from the, you know?
Aren't you supposed to, as an actor, feel like, I'm going to get out there and I'm going to show them what I can do and almost like look forward to auditions?
See, as I say in my monologue, I'm missing that go-for-it spirit, you know, that really, I'm not driven in that way. You know, and you know, it. Every time I'm about to go on a big tour, I have these offers come up, and they wanted me to read for Polonius for the Kevin Kline production of Hamlet in New York, and I didn't because I had already committed to Australia, and I guess I'm more interested in these kind of serendipitous journeys like Australia and going to Bali and doing those things. If something comes up in the films, I'll do it, but I don't chase after it, you know.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is performance artist Spalding Gray, and he's performing at the Painted Bright Arts Center through Saturday night, and they're at 2nd and Vine Streets. Did this hatred of auditions and contribute to your leaving at least temporarily leaving acting, stage acting?
Well, I went into the Underground Theater really in 1970 when I joined the performance group. And I would say that probably the audition thing and the whole high-pressure thing and the need to be a part of a group to nurture a way of working, all of those things were playing into it. But as I do say in the monologue, Terrors of Pleasure, that I'm doing here, I talk about how I would come into, I would always have the fantasy that I was the only actor up for the role. I mean, I knew I wasn't, but it was a fantasy, you know. And you come into that waiting room, and no one knows you from anyone else there when I was just starting out. And you start looking around at these people and you want to kill these other actors. You know, all of that competition comes up. And then the other side of it is, oh, God, look at that guy. You know, he could do it just as well. Or he could do it better. Or who am I? You know, what am I bringing special to this situation? And I had to go find my own specialness. And I've taken a long, circuitous route. And I'm ready to come back. And I'm ready to do films. I don't think I'm ready to do plays anymore. Theater, although I occasionally go to it, theater doesn't interest me as much as film.
Why is it?
Because film, for me, is going in and framing the real world. And theater is going into a space that refers to itself. It's a theatrical space. And I worked in theater for so long, in the performing garage, in some traditional plays, in a lot of experimental plays. And I called it the windowless art house. What excited me in The Killing Fields was being out in what you would call a normal, relatively normal, natural environment, everyday plays, and watching how it's framed and made into special time by the film. So that we were doing a night shoot, I remember, of a bombing of the American Embassy on New Year's Eve. This was cut from the film. They didn't have this in the film. For two nights, we stayed up all night long, slept in the day. And it was like a Robert Wilson piece. It was so beautiful because nothing ever changed. But yet it was an actual environment. But there was a man-made pond with candles in it. You know, it was supposed to be a big embassy party. And I remember this Thai boy, for continuity, would keep swimming out into the middle of the pond and relighting and redoing those candles so that they never burn down. So it has the magic moment of the stage, but even more magical because it's informed and changed our everyday realities. They're not props. You know, they're real candles it's a man-made pond, but a real pond in the middle of this real field with all these people sitting around a table waiting to eat caviar, and eventually by dawn the caviar is rotting because they don't eat it, and the next day we're out there again. And the same with David's film. The way we were doing, David had David Byrne's film, he had a talent show in this huge stage with the plastic walls, green plastic walls, way out in the middle of a prairie. And he had local talent from all over Texas come for that show because he had auditioned for them. He had Boy Scouts doing routines about child molestation, how to avoid having your children picked up by perverts. You know, these incredible shows. He had the Blue Line Golden Age dancers group that would, of old people, senior citizens that danced to Elvira, and it was just this incredible. There were baton whirlers, you know, and he's out in the middle of this Texas prairie. And it's lit. It looks like a flying saucer. And you're standing under the stars. And a big storm came up and blew it down. And standing out there in that Texas prairie, I looked back at the lights of the houses, and I felt like I was walking on water. I suddenly didn't miss the ocean anymore. I always thought I would feel landlocked. And it was like standing on the ocean, looking back at the shore. And those are beautiful, exciting, timeless moments because they are framed by the reality of the film. I would never be standing out in Texas. That's what I love about films. I would never walk out into a Texas prairie and look back at this point in my life. But that leads me to it. The film does.
I guess all this preoccupation with tearing down the fourth wall and everything in the theater ends up being irrelevant in movies anyway.
Yeah, right. And I've been inside a building, inside a theater for so long. It just, the whole outside thing has opened up my head in a wonderful way.
Did you ever have the urge to play Hamlet and do Chekhov, mm-hmm, do the great
mm-hmm,
roles?
Mm-hmm. Way back when I was in college and I acted in every play over 4 years at Emerson College, and I just was sure that was my life was going to be an actor. When I got out, I was going to do, I had done scenes from Hamlet, I was going to act in regional theater. And I wanted to do Chekhov. I wanted to do I had been in a couple of productions at the Seagull. I wouldn't want to do Astroff and Uncle Vanya. And now I've lost it. The most recent offer was to play Dr. Dorn for Larry Sacro's production of The Seagull at Birdcliff Theatre with Joanne Woodward, who was playing Madame Arkadina. And it was a choice between that and playing my own work at the Goodman Theatre, and I went for my own work. And I keep saying I want to get back to the stage. And I said, well, I would play Polonius if it was Spalding Gray in a plaid shirt and dungarees trying to remember Polonius's lines. You see, I have a real battle with lines. I think it's a part of my dyslexia.
Dyslexia?
I have mild dyslexia. And it's not as... I know there are worse cases where you see where words are just abstract. But if I try to read too fast, the letters begin to bounce around and I'll see saw as was. So I'm a slow reader, dyslexia. And therefore, I digest very well. But if I can't do a cold reading in an audition. And even if I have the text in front of me, it bounces around. And another thing I can't do is to shift between reading and speaking. Although I was able to do it last night, I was trying to do it when I was in Adelaide in Australia. I was doing a monologue about Australia, and I wanted to read from Freud's one of Freud's books, Civilization is Discontents. And I opened, well, Freud's pretty difficult to read, but I opened it, and I couldn't make sense of the damn thing. The words didn't hold together.
It's really hard to believe because, I'm not saying I distrust you or anything, but you do your performances so swiftly. I mean, you talk so quickly when you want to, and you have the whole thing more or less memorized, and it's staggering because it's maybe like a 90-minute or 60-minute monologue.
No,
I know you've got your notes, but you don't really look at them that much.
There's a difference between memorizing. That's an interesting point. I cannot memorize a text that someone else has written and get it right every night. I even with Sam Shepard's Tooth of Crime, the director was always taking notes on that. But I can speak my pieces, which are not memorized, but I'm seeing a film. When I'm telling those stories, I am clearly seeing the film of those stories. So I'm really describing what's coming into my mind. If it had to be memorized, I couldn't do it.
Right, so you don't have to get it word for word, and no one's got to follow, you know, get their cue from you so that they can say their lines.
Well, the pressure's not on me. I don't function well under pressure. That's part of why I'm not out there grabbing the big film roles.
And it sounds like you're really not interested in the stage that much anymore. And maybe you're really more of an auteur, you know, who wants to.
Well, I'd like to write more.
Yeah.
I would like to write more. I consider what I'm doing here not writing as much as speaking. I mean, it's a form of oral writing, but I would like to write something that hasn't been spoken first and see what happens there because I'm interested in the act of privacy and how that would change what's disclosed.
In fleshing out your onstage Spalding Gray character, has that brought you in touch with different parts of yourself that were maybe not very developed before?
The humor, definitely. I really got my sense of humor when I came to New York City. And that was a combination of you've got to laugh to be in that place. And the other was being exposed to Judaism on a large scale like that. And finally having a Jewish girlfriend.
Oh.
No, that wasn't funny. They have a great sense of humor. And they're very extroverted. And I had grown up with introverted WASPs who have this very dry sense of humor. Which is a sense of humor. I'm not saying that it's not there. But there was a certain broadness that I discovered through being in New York and being exposed to that in people. And so there's that. And the other thing that I have been able to do is to travel and to be alone now that I'm a writer or now that I know that it can be material. And before, I really used to disappear a lot, just feeling very anxious about being in a place where no one recognized me. And since I've been learned how to take notes, there's an aspect of me, the writer, that recognizes the person, Spalding Gray. There's a very clear schism now where I'm always watching my life for experiences that can be used and sometimes creating the experiences, which I make a joke about in the monologue where I say, uh-oh, did I buy this house in order to make this monologue, because now it's come full circle. I was in Cambridge performing last year, and a woman who's reviewing a very academic book on postmodern theater. Ellie Fuchs, who's a freelance writer for The Village Voice, has a grant up there, and she's studying Cambridge. And she said, you know, I thought I couldn't include you in my book. And now I've seen your monologue about the house, and I now know that you're a postmodernist writer in this sense. And she had, it's all theoretical, right? There's some a French semiotic philosopher who says that the sign of postmodernism is that the act, map of the act exists before the event. He uses nuclear war as an example to say that we know where the nuclear war is going to be fought. It's all on computer. And this is a postmodern condition. And she said, you bought that house in order to make the monologue. Therefore, you're a postmodernist. And now you can be in my book.
So you're going to be in it. So does this mean that before you came to New York, you were a very kind of like serious artist, that you didn't, you weren't funny?
Yeah. No sense of humor at all. No sense of humor. In fact, I can remember an old girlfriend that I had. In fact, she's the one that I used to make love in front of the Burning Misanthrope set with. She had been a girlfriend at Emerson College, and then she came to visit me in New York after I'd been living there for about 2 years. And a bunch of us were sitting around, and she was just seeing me for the first time in a long time. And afterwards, she said, I didn't know you were funny. You were funny. You were making me laugh. You were never funny when I knew you. What happened? No, that was really heavy. Really. Oh, God. When I was at Emerson College, I would go to sleep at 10 o'clock every night listening to Dylan Thomas read Fernhill. That would be my tranquilizer.
I mean, how do you get to be funny? I understand what exposed you to humor and everything, but I always think of humor as being something you're either, you know, born with or not in a way. It's not something you can... The deadliest people are the people who decide, well, I think I ought to add a little humor to my life.
You know, I think it was there with me, and I think it went underground when... it was there with me in high school. I was a real clown, cutting up a lot, blah, 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 but I think it went underground during that heavy puberty time, and it was just, I turned into this really kind of existentially death-obsessed poet in college with just morbid.
Was that really good for getting girls, by the way?
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't, really?
No. I was really, truly disturbed. I didn't have many girlfriends in college, not until my senior year. No, I was into suffering. I was really into suffering, and I lived in an alley. Because I took the cheapest apartment I could find, you know, to help my father out. And I was working as the janitor there. And it was $35 a month because I was emptying trash. And this alley was filled with rats in Boston because they have these. And you could only enter into the apartment from the alley. We called it Rat Alley. And no one would come to visit me. You can imagine a girl coming there in any hour. At night, I'd have to come home clapping my hands. Then the rats would scurry out of the way. No kidding. I was like Edgar Allan Poe, morbid. And, you know, I had to enter into my apartment directly from the street, which meant there was no entrance way. A rat could have scurried right in there. So I didn't have any girlfriends, freshman, sophomore. I mean, it was Emerson College. Most of them were Jewish women up from New York who were into musical comedy and laughs. I mean, I was playing the wrong role. If I had been at Harvard and was acting that way, maybe it would have been different.
With your name Spalding Gray, a lot of people assume that you, I don't know if you are or not, that you're from a family who had money. So it's
right.
It's interesting to hear you, you know, living on Rat Alley.
Isn't it funny, though? Because somewhere my mother must have been longing for money because, well, my father together, because my brother is named Rockwell and Channing, and I'm Spalding, you know. And everyone's kind of looking to where the inheritance is or saying, do you have to do with the Spalding balls? But no, I don't have any money.
My guest is Spalding Gray, and he's performing his latest monologue, The Terrors of Pleasure, and he'll be doing that through Saturday night at the Painted Bride Art Center, and then he's taking it in a couple of his earlier monologues to Lincoln Center. One of the things that you really use your humor for so well is describing your own neurosis, which happens to be similar to neuroses that a lot of us have, and... It makes it seem, it's so effortless and everything when you're on stage, and it makes it seem like, wow, neuroses aren't that bad. They're really pretty funny. And in fact, they're not funny to have them at all. It's funny to describe them when you're funny at it.
Mm-hmm.
But do your like problems ever strike you as being funny at the time?
No, they don't. It's not an overly painful situation, but it's an annoying situation because it's a repeat of... It gets boring because it's a repeat. The same neuroses keep coming back, and you get bored with it, and you think, now, wait a minute, I think, can I you know, it's going to be a point where I just can't turn these into monologues any longer. Maybe you can. Woody Allen's able to do one a year, you know, a film a year. I should be able to do a monologue a year if you have enough variety and setting and change it. But, you know, for instance, one of my problems is like taking a vacation, the neurosis about the vacation, and being able to just unwind and do nothing. And I got to, I did a little journalism in Australia and earned some extra money and decided I had always wanted to go to Bali, and I was going to go there and I was going to relax. And I got there and I started freaking out the first couple of days I was there. And then three people recognized me on the street of Ubud when I was in the art center. One woman was teaching me in a class of hers in Cincinnati. Another guy had seen me perform in Boston. Another woman had been in a workshop of mine in Santa Cruz. And so they were kind of leading me into this art community there, and I was starting to touch down, you know, finding myself in the landscape. And I got relaxed after about 5 days, and I said, now I'm going to go a little bit further. I saw all these people on motorcycles, you know. I said, I am going to rent a motorcycle and take a trip, a pleasurable trip up to this beautiful beach on the East Coast. Now I'm going to go a little bit further, and I got real nervous about all of this. I mean, it was a chaotic day, you know, because I could feel the neurosis coming on. And to avoid drinking a lot, I'd been going a cocktail hour. Every cocktail hour, I go to a Balinese healer, a Balian, who is the most wonderful man who was laughing all the time at me. He thought, because originally I went there and told him I was in three places at once, and he said he had never had anyone come in with that disease. Maybe I should get a shot, you know, of something. He wanted to send me away. Then he got out these magical drawings that his grandfather had done, pencil drawings, and we went through it to try to find a drawing that would fit my condition. I was in Sydney in my head, I was in New York in my head, and I was in Bali a week before I was there in my head, you know, because Laurie Anderson had been there and I'd missed the gamelan concert they had done for her, right? So I was in Bali, but a week before I got there, right? So we get out this beautiful drawing of this guy with no head and four legs, and his eyes are in his chest. So the healer does a mantra about that, you know, and does a copy of it for me. He copies it. And I have to have this picture over my bed. Then I say, now, wait a minute. My house is collapsing up in the Catskills. Let's do a picture for that. So we go through all the pictures. He does a special mantra for the house. So this has got to be framed and hung in the house. Then I told him that I thought part of why I couldn't take a vacation, why I was so riled up, was because my mother committed suicide when I was taking a vacation in Mexico, you know, in the summer, and that this is coming back on me. It was kind of Freudian theory. Oh, yes, he understood this. Now, he spoke very little English, but he understood what I was saying. And on a particular day of the dead, it was, too, it was a Sunday the 13th, and it was, there'd been a lot of, I'd go into a trance dance at a temple that afternoon where priests completely freaked out and went into trance. It took four people to hold them down, you know, each one of them under a new moon. It was beautiful. And then I rode on my bike to this Balian. And it was dark, and he did a whole ceremony for my mother's spirit, and we picked out a drawing for her, and he was going to lay her spirit to rest. His wife made an offering, and the whole thing, you know, and he did a mantra. It was very powerful for me, and then I ate the offering, and I thought, now I've got a drawing that says total protection. My mother's spirit is laid to rest. I'm going to take this motorcycle, you know, up to this beach, and I'm going to have a good time, right? And he told me the day to travel on. By the way, he got down the Balinese calendar. Now, it took me so long to get the motorcycle together and get everything going that I could tell night was coming on. It was a two-hour trip up to this beach. And I thought, now maybe I should travel tomorrow when I'm fresh, you know. And he said, no, he said it was a bad day to travel tomorrow. I've got to go today. So I'm off, and it's a great trip, and everything is fine. But night falls in those countries near the equator, like just there. And it's been 98 degrees, and all of a sudden it's night, and I'm riding in a kind of damp T-shirt and shorts on this motorcycle, and I can feel this cold coming on. I mean, it came on within a minute, you know, and I ended up with this unbelievable head cold on this most idyllic beach, you know. So I knew it was subconscious. I couldn't even get a hold of that. You know, that was the angering part. I had everything consciously worked out, you know. Oh, God, that was so, I lay on that beach so depressed, and it was so idyllic, and it was so beautiful. Of course, beauty terrifies me.
You'll never be that prepared for a vacation again.
I know, everything. I mean, exactly. It was, everything was pointed toward ecstasy. Everything.
So what's holding you back from letting go and enjoying yourself?
We don't know, do we? Because that unconscious let the cold in. Imagine catching a cold in Bali, come on. 98 degrees, a head cold. It's like a nightmare. Feel like you have a fever all the time.
You know, I think that there's a real fine line when you're on stage between revealing things about yourself and having people just laughing hysterically and thinking, oh, God, I'm like that too. God, that's so funny. Aren't we absurd? And people thinking, oh, the poor guy.
Right,
you know,
right.
he just can't relax and have a good time. That's really pathetic. I feel sorry for him.
Right.
Did it ever happen to you that in doing a monologue and instead of the kind of hysterical response that, that somebody...
It
actually
happened.
Started feeling sorry for
lot.
You, really?
It happened a lot. I won't say they were feeling sorry for me, but one thing I realized touring Australia as soon as I got out of Sydney was that my monologues are all built in front of a New York audience. Therefore, the humor is a New York sensibility. You know, it's about that irony. It's about playing off universes. Well, Sydney, Australia, picked up on most of that. I got to Melbourne next. Of course, Melbourne will not like anything that Sydney likes, so they'll read the reviews just to make sure. If they got a good review, they won't like it. This is competition between the two cities. In fact, someone told me when I first got there, they said the difference between Melbourne and Sydney is if someone in Melbourne has an idea, they publish it. If someone in Sydney has an idea, they throw a party. And that really typifies the two places. I got to Melbourne, and those people were so serious. And I felt like I was in Bergman's film, The Wild Strawberries, when the guy's being judged by all of those cutout in the nightmare. And I'm thinking, my God, I've got to go back into therapy. My life is a mess. Look, because it's all about the relationship between me and the audience. They're looking at me like... So Melbourne, they thought they were laughing a lot because they had nothing to compare it to. Then I went to Tasmania. Then I went to Perth, which is the most distant, isolated city in the world. And in Perth, they were silent. Silent. I would play that thing. I would just, you know, luckily Renee was there. I would play it. I would go home. I would drink a couple of Cooper's Ales and watch TV and go to bed and just say, this is a job. Go to the beach in the day. It was scary. It was scary. It was weird. I'm not saying they weren't listening. I'm sure they were getting something from it, but I don't know what.
But you were more like this weird specimen on stage, probably.
Yeah,
than,
I think so.
Than
this
crazy telling us
American.
About us.
Look
yeah.
at this American. And I would have people write me letters, actually. When I left Sydney, letters would catch up with me saying, stop pouring salt on your wounds. Do Vipassana meditation. It just takes 10 days, you know. I'm not a proselytizer. There were more people that tried to help me in Australia than anywhere else. They were nice. They were genuine. But everyone had a different therapy that they thought I should go into. And you know, I'm not denying it. I would like to go to one of these Vipassana meditation retreats. But bottom line for me is humor. Bottom line for me. And I just know I would end up making, you know, if I had the togetherness and I had the afterlife, I'd end up making fun of death. You know, if I had a proper medium to come back. But that's the only one I know I'm not going to have a comment on.
Do you think that performing in Lincoln Center might be in its way like performing at Bali? You know, yeah. I don't know if there's a subscription audience there or not, but I wonder if there'll be a lot of
not
people
performing
who...
in Bali, but performing in Melbourne.
In Melbourne,
Australia.
I mean, yeah, right. Where they were like really serious and they didn't get it. I mean, I just
well,
don't know.
Well, that's one of the things I'm interested in. It's going to be a total uptown audience. I think a lot of people may have heard of me but never have seen me. More and more people are coming downtown to see me at the Performing Garage. But not that many. In their metal chairs, it's uncomfortable. They're going to have a posh seats in Lincoln Center. And it's a New York Times ad, which I've never had. It's a big New York Times ad. And there's an interview coming out in the Arts and Leisure this Sunday with Don Shuey. So it'll be good publicity. They're doing a 3-sheet poster for the subways.
Wow.
So they'll be in all the subways. And
people are going to recognize you everywhere.
No, that's not a very good picture.
It's not a good picture.
I'm just sitting behind a table. It's a larger names than picture. But that's one of the reasons I'm curious about doing Lincoln Center. I'm wondering how it's going to go over with that audience, because it will be like playing in a very foreign city. It'll be like going on tour.
Say it doesn't go over, what would that say to you? I mean, it probably will, but say...
Oh,
I
God.
Mean, I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I don't know what it'll say to me in a year from now, but what it'll say to me when it doesn't go over was I'll just start drinking and you know, I'll just get depressed and what have you. I mean, I met someone in Bali that said that she knew a man that that said he could get anything he wanted in 15 minutes or there was a lesson to be learned. He had died for 15 minutes from falling off a hang glider. He'd been technically dead and had spent the rest of his life trying to get back to that 15 minutes because it was so glorious. But he had gotten in such a control state in his head that he could get anything he wanted or willed within 15 minutes or there was a lesson to be learned. And I hope that I would have the courage to look at Lincoln Center like that, that there was a lesson to be learned. Stay downtown. It's like the fisherman's wife, you know. The fisherman's wife, they finally end up after the castle back in the shack, you know. I'd go back humbly to the Performing Garage and start all over again.
Are you going to change your clothes for Lincoln Center? Your audience will be coming different, dressed differently.
I bought two new shirts. You know, when I came in for the photo call for the New York Times, I was wearing a $10, beautiful $10 silk antique suit that I'd bought in McKinney, Texas, in a thrift shop, with a black T-shirt. The only thing it wasn't Miami Vice was that I had shaved.
And it wasn't pastel.
Right.
Black is not Miami Vice color.
Exactly, that's right. And I was running through a monologue for the photographer, and in rushed the press agent from Lincoln Center. And he said, oh, you got by me. I was waiting downstairs for you. I said, I didn't even see you. He said, we were gonna recommend a button-down collar. And I said, you're kidding. He said, yes. But I don't think he was. So I did. I bought that shirt you saw last night from Lincoln Center. You know, it's kind of as a costume.
This is the T-shirt you put on
afterwards?
I bought the
collar shirt.
The collar shirt. Collar. Oh, okay.
And I bought two of them, actually, at Lord & Taylor. So I will bill Lincoln Center for them. So to some extent, I'm outfitting myself for the uptown.
It was a very nice shirt.
Yeah, yeah. Should be.
for those Lord prices.
Taylor. Yeah.
My guest is Spalding Gray, and he's going to be doing his latest monologue, The Terrors of Pleasure, tonight through Saturday night at the Painted Bright Art Center on 2nd and Vine Streets, and then he's taking it to Lincoln Center. One of the things that's held together a lot of your monologues is an obsession with the perfect moment, with finding the perfect moment. Where does that come from? When did you first start wanting the perfect moment?
See, I always wanted it and didn't know. I didn't have a name for it. In fact, both my older brother and I both have had cravings for that, particularly Rocky, my older brother. And I don't know what it came from. Something to do with the relationship to my mother, who was constantly questing for ecstatic states. She was very concerned with that. And I've always been concerned with all mood changes. My ally is alcohol. That produces the mood change that I feel best with. And I have to be very careful with it because it's an ally. I don't want it to work against me. When I first conceived of the word was reading when I first adopted the word was reading a book on Sartre's works. It was an analysis of nausea, and they kept referring to Sartre's idea of the perfect moment being the bourgeois concept of when the bourgeois or ego gets in a place where everything seems to revolve around it is the perfect moment, when raw, indifferent nature coincides with the human ego. And the imperfect moment could also be a perfect moment. I mean, to lose that ego, which I've also experienced, and that is another perfect moment. But usually it's when all the elements agree with you.
And, of course, it's great. It's very difficult for you to experience the perfect moment because if you can't enjoy yourself on the beach on vacation, how are you going to find the perfect moment?
Exactly. And I thought that I needed a new ally when I got to Bali, and I was looking for the infamous magic mushrooms. Everyone has always talked about the magic mushrooms in Bali. So when I got into Ubud, into the art center, into the hills, that's when I began to ask. I didn't ask down the Kuta Beach. It's so crazy. And mainly younger people there now, 28, 30 years old that I was meeting, and they were saying, oh, no. In fact, one guy who was studying dance that had seen me perform, and he'd been there for 6 months, said, I took so many drugs in college, I don't touch them anymore. I used to do my homework on opium, you know. He was another generation, you know. And a woman said, the only people who have asked for the magic mushrooms up here are kind of like old alternative people that have been drifting through, you know. And go out and look at the stars. My God, who would need to take magic? Isn't this beautiful? So they weren't even available to me, you know. I met an old Balinese gardener who said for a little bit of money he'd go out and look in cow shit for them because that's where they grow after it rains. So I didn't have any allies. I was completely on my own, and I'd cut down terrifically on the drinking because it was so hot there. So looking back on it, you know, it was a good vacation except for the cold. There were no perfect moments, but they are rare. They are rare to come by, really.
Have you had any?
And have I? Oh, yeah. I talk about it in Swimming to Cambodia in the Indian Ocean. When I was doing Killing Fields, yeah, when I dismelted with the ocean, it was very beautiful. I've had some near-perfect ones in Australia, but, you know, my brother Rocky is looking for them, and I can remember he married late, and his wife is one of those really, she had been married before, really down-to-earth Jewish mother types, and he came home from, he teaches at a boys' school, and he came home one day and went, oh, God, I haven't had an ecstatic moment in days. And she said, what? What did you say? An ecstatic woman? How many of those do you expect to have in a lifetime? She just laid into him, you know. And the two of us are always going around like that, you know, just dreaming, like, when's it going to come next? I don't know what that has to do with. It's some sort of two-year-old consciousness.
You know, I remember in Swimming to Cambodia, you had a lot of, I guess, Thai or Cambodian, I forget which, marijuana that you were smoking, and it would make you really paranoid a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And in our last interview, I'd asked you about why you were smoking it, if it made you paranoid, yeah. And you talked about being interested in psychotic states and things like that.
Yeah.
But I noticed in your new monologue, you're
this,
drinking.
It's drug-free, but it isn't. The alcohol's there. The alcohol's always been there for me. So it's in my genes, because I'm Gray is from Northern Ireland, from just outside... where is it? It's Brunswick, Northern Ireland, right on the water. And the drinking has always been there. It was less in Thailand. It was less in Bali because it's not a drinking culture. And I didn't smoke a lot of marijuana in Thailand, maybe four times compared to, say, other people who are habituated to it and would have it every day and not notice any mood change at all. But I know if you hear the monologue, it sounds like I did. But I didn't... I've never have had a relaxed experience on it. It's always keyed me up. It does something to my chemistry. And so I'm just real careful with it. If I'm going to dance all night or something or go running on the beach or swimming, it's all right. But I'm jealous of people that are relaxed by it because it would seem to me a healthy way to rest my liver. When I was working with my editor I was out in the Hamptons and had a wonderful experience with that designer drug, ecstasy, before it was outlawed, because I was able to relax enough to find my swimming again. I had never been able to swim in a relaxed way for years. Fear of sharks, fear of the unknown, whatever, I would tense up. And that was a great aid in that. And when I was in Australia, I realized I could recall the experience because it was very vivid of feeling finally that the water was a substance that was holding me up. And that it was my ally, that it was not pulling me down. And also I learned a breath rhythm. So when I was swimming every day in Australia, that's the beauty of that place. Every city has an excellent, non-polluted, free beach. It's really egalitarian. So swimming has been a new therapy for me.
Are you still interested in flirting with psychotic states?
Not right now. I'm really kind of interested in slowing down. When I was in Australia, I started hearing some tapes of Stanislav Grof, the man that worked with LSD therapy. And since I really missed the LSD, I didn't gobble it like candy. I maybe took it 10 or 12 times, and I never was in a place where I could really regress. And I began to have ideas that I wanted to do some LSD therapy. Why I thought of that in Australia, I don't know. And when I went to this Balinese healer, they're called the Balians, is the word for them, the technical word, the actual name. The first thing I went to him was, and I went with a translator, and I said, in the United States, we have a LSD therapist, a very famous one, Stanislav Grof, and he takes LSD, gives LSD to his patients and guides them through. I want you to get the magic mushrooms for me and take the trip with me. I want you to be my guide. Oh, he laughed. He just went, no, 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 no. These are poison. They're confusing your mind. You must give up all drugs, stop drinking, and begin to, you know, clear yourself out while you're here. So I took his advice.
So no more.
It was good.
That.
It wasn't an ecstatic vacation, but it was relaxed, with the exception of the cold. Still coughing.
My guest is Spalding Gray, and he's performing his new monologue, The Terrors of Pleasure, through Saturday night at the Painted Bride Arts Center. You're really successful in the art world now, but not so much like in the TV world, right? So now you have friends who you've worked with who've really made it big. Like, I think you work with Dustin Hoffman in a performance, right? And John Malkovich was Swimming to Cambodia. And, well, they even teamed up together in Death of a Salesman on TV. Are you jealous of people like that ever?
Yes, I am. I'm very jealous of John. John's still a friend, but I hear that he is playing Mr. Right in the new Susan Seidelman film, and everyone was saying that I would have been perfect for it. Mm. And Susan didn't approach me. She approached John because John will get his money, you know. The producer will invest in John Malkovich. And I'm jealous and feel left behind. And there's a new performer called David Cale who's performing at PS 122 out of England, and he... got a big write-up in The Voice saying Downtown's best-kept secret, he's a cross between Spalding Gray and Eric Bogosian. And next thing I hear is David Cale is in the new Woody Allen movie, and Renee is saying, wait a minute, why aren't you in it? You know, why didn't your agent send you up for it? I went to school with Juliet Taylor. I went to Smith College with her, who cast for Woody Allen. And so that's when I get upset. I would love to work with Woody Allen. I like him a lot. I mean, there's not. I'd like to work with Jim Jarmusch. There's not that many people I'd like to work with. But when I'm not doing it and I see other people doing it, and I don't think that I'm, like, in the art world anymore. I wasn't up for the artsies. I mean, I wasn't invited for those awards. I am traveling a lot, so I'm performing in a lot of different theater situations, but not so much in galleries or art houses now. More in traditional theater settings. Painted Bride is not an example of that, but certainly in Australia.
Oh, but we're so glad you keep coming, you know. It's really...
I've been coming to Painted Bride for so many years.
Yeah, everyone's really grateful, I think, that you know...
Well, I like
in spite of the
back.
Fact you're doing like Lincoln Center, you're doing The Bride also.
Yeah. And I did The Bride instead of going to Vietnam, which was a tough choice. I was supposed to go on this.
This time?
Yes, it happened. The trip happened. I was supposed to do the first American cultural exchange with Vietnam with Tom Bird and Bill Irwin. Tom Bird is, well, Bill Irwin, you must know.
Yeah.
Tom is a producer of Tracers and head of the Vietnam Veterans Ensemble Theater. And that's part of why I was waiting around in Australia, because we were supposed to go the 14th of April. Nothing happened. Then the 21st, the day before I left Sydney, I called and Renee said, there's an announcement in the New York Times that you are going with Tom Bird on the 27th. Well, I was really furious and depressed and sad that this had happened. And I didn't know who was responsible for changing the dates. I don't know who to get angry with. Had I done it, I would have had to cancel The Bride and arrived back from Vietnam 3 days before Lincoln Center, which would have been coming in, because I jet-lagged for a week after Australia. So I thought, well, it's just not in the cards now. I'm going to have to try to redo this thing myself and go to Vietnam. And I thought that I should do that because I wasn't going in good faith. I was going as a spy because I was going as a cultural representative of the United States, in which I was supposed to meet with other writers and see Vietnamese theater and dance and musicians and try to initiate an exchange between them and America. That would be a displacement of my real interest. My real interest is to go to Vietnam as a monologist, as a journalist, as an observer, and to be taken around by a guide and say, this is... You know, this is what we can show you. Not the art scene so much as the life scene. And I was using the art exchange, the cultural exchange idea, to peek through the holes. And I'm very sorry I couldn't go on this trip, and I hope to set up one of my own. A year from, 1988, because I'm about to do a year residency at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles. This is a golden grant. They have gotten me a grant to hang out in the streets of Los Angeles, go to interesting areas, ride the buses of L.A., and find good storytellers. I mean, you know, good talkers. People come up to me all the time and start rapping, and then stage a festival with them. So that's going to be all next year, and I stage the festival at the Mark Taper Forum in April.
What is it about you that attracts people like that, you know, like eccentrics who talk a lot and even crazy people sometimes, too, from what I gather?
I look spaced out when I'm on the street.
Is that
I look like I'm not going anywhere, because when I'm really relaxed, lately I haven't looked like I'm not going anywhere because of Lincoln Center and the publicity, and I've been rushing around. In fact, last Sunday, a guy was staggering toward me in Washington Square Park, barefoot, and he said, can I talk to you? Can I talk to you? Can I tell you a story? And I just went, nope. And he turned to me and said, why not? You know, he actually challenged me. And he didn't know who I was. He was picking up on my vibes, and I said, because I'm going somewhere, that's why. And I got two blocks down the road, and I went, oh no, I've got to talk with that guy. I'm not really going anywhere. I can't believe I did that. What's happening to you, Spalding? You're closing down. And I went back 3-4 blocks and searching for him and couldn't find him. You know, I knew I was getting shut down. Most of the time, I'm pretty open. I'm in two veins. When I'm performing, I'm shut down because I got to open up at night, you know. And when I'm not performing and I'm absorbing, like I will be in L.A., then I'm serendipitous. And I'm like a conduit, and I think people pick up on that.
Well, you've tried to bring that out in other people, too, because in one of your shows, Interviewing the Audience,
right.
You have people on stage and you solicit stories from them, you interview them. What did you learn about interviewing doing that? I have professional interest in this.
that... Not everyone can tell a story well, you know, that they can't come out. And I've gotten better at choosing people. I had to make a choice between whether I was going to labor with that in front of an audience, like a workshop, or take people that I could tell immediately. Now, I can tell immediately in the lobby when I talk with them by the way that they banter with me. So, you know, if we quickly get a 1-2-1-2 ping pong conversation going, then I know it's going to be good. And so I think that the other thing, the pulling of teeth, belongs in this classroom, the workshop, I mean, the situation. If I was teaching, or I had thought of doing a piece, not a piece, but a thing where I would have, as an experiment, instead of interviewing form, it was public, it would be totally private, in which someone could come to me as and confess to me and then leave. I didn't grow up as a Catholic. It sounds like a confessional, but with the absolute guarantee that it would not go outside of the room, because I think there's a power in that. There's certain things that people have to unload and that the receiver takes on that they can't do with a therapist, that they prefer not to do with a therapist because they have a relationship with that therapist, you know, and they want to also be in control of it, or with a friend even. And so, God, there's that, you know, level that I've thought of exploring, although I have never been able to keep a secret. So I don't think it would work to make that promise. In other words, taking on the burden of the secret is finally what, in my mind, causes cancer. I mean, for me it would, because it's a flow for me. I'm a conduit. I tell stories that are stories told to me, and I keep them going. And it's all about that networking and communication that's other than big media. That's the news for me. You know, personal rumor and gossip and stories is the real news.
You know, with people saying that some of them don't speak that well, some of them won't tell as good a story, it's almost feel like you're discriminating, you know, that you're not
yep, I
not
am.
Giving them equal access because they're not good. Mm. This happens to us all the time in radio, you know, in a talk show. And you say no to someone and you just feel terrible.
I know, and I want to be egalitarian and real, feel I really be democratic, but I know there are some people that just... shape and edit on the spot and talk back and listen to themselves. It's simply that one other element of the listener, and other people just a raw being with no censor, you know.
That's right.
And then I end up being the censor.
Well, you know, you have a book coming out too in June. It's how many monologues are in it?
Six, including Terrors of Pleasure, I think. It's 47 beds, booze, cars, and college girls, sex and death at the age 14. Travels through New England, and nobody wanted to sit behind a desk in Terrors of Pleasure.
You've always denied that they're written things and refer to them as oral pieces, but here they are in print. Are you happy with them as literary pieces?
Yeah, I haven't read through the most recent galley, but I am, and I am because...
Is it transcribed, or did you just down and write it?
We worked on it. My editor and I decided we would blend the transcription and writing. So we worked for about 3 weeks intently going over to make it very readable so that it's like a voice. You hear the voice in it, and it's like the book is speaking right to you, but a lot of the ands, ahs, and repeats, you know, it's cleaned up. It's cleaned up.
Well, I'm hoping that when the book is published, maybe you'll be back in Philadelphia. We could talk about your writing and
topic. I think the book was coming out June 9th, and it'll be the title of Sex and Death at the Age 14.
And I'll mention the publisher, which is Vintage. And if you want to see Spalding Gray perform, he's doing his latest monologue, The Terrors of Pleasure, tonight through Saturday night at the Painted Bride Arts Center. And they're at 2nd and Vine Streets. And for more information, you can call them at 925-9914. That's 925-9914, and June is going to be a big month. Not only does the book come out, but the run starts
with a possible extension.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah,
and that's at Lincoln Center
at the Mitzi Newhouse Theater, the small theater. Yeah.
And when's the film open? I feel like Johnny Carson.
Oh, right. Well, good. See, at last I've gotten here. I don't know. I talked with David on the phone just 2 days ago, and he said that it's finished. They finished the editing, and they're now showing it, you know, in preview houses, like in Seattle, to test it out. And they haven't chosen a distributor yet. It's not that they won't get a distributor, but as soon as they choose one, then September, I would say safely.
Great. I can't wait to see it. Okay, well, thanks a lot
for
being with us. And my guest has been Spalding Gray. It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio in 2 minutes for All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Up in East Norton, there's an accident on Route 202 southbound at the Johnson Highway. Also on the eastbound Pennsylvania Turnpike, traffic is jammed east of Norristown. An accident off on the shoulder further west on the westbound Turnpike, exiting at Fort Washington, an overturned tractor-trailer. Traveling north on 95, it's closed at Route 281 because of a tractor-trailer accident. All traffic must exit there. North on 95 as well, a minor delay at the Ben Franklin Bridge. Schuylkill Expressway westbound, a 25-minute delay at City Avenue. Eastbound, 20 minutes in traffic approaching the Conshohocken Curve. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM, WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by the Philadelphia Business Journal. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by novelist Martin Cruz Smith, and his books include the novel Gorky Park. This Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be crime reporter Nicholas Pileggi, who's author of the book Wise Guy Life in a Mafia Family, which is about the heists and scams of mid-level mobsters, so I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Joyce Lieberman and Dan Lachlan were the engineers. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I produce the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up from National Public Radio. It's 5 o'clock.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Susan Stamberg.
This is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
The skipper who brings the America's Cup back is, in addition to being famous, he's probably going to be worth $2 or $3 million right after that seventh race.
Not bad for a sailor, but the America's Cup race is not just a sail, it's a gold mine. And American syndicates are spending millions to win the cup back from Australia.